Alcatraz, Alcatraz. Few have seen your beauty like the Indian has.
And that was Redbone from their album Potlatch, talking about Alcatraz, which is one thing we're going to be talking about today. I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am here with my co-host, Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning, Paul.
Get your mic all set up there. We have a really amazing guest here. We're very fortunate to have Lineda Warjack to talk about Alcatraz and many other things. She has been active in many fields as an activist and organizer, a tribal leader from her tribe, the Shoshone Bannock, a professor of federal Indian law, and many other hats. And 50 years ago, on November 20, 1969, she, along with dozens of other Native American activists, she was one of the leaders and organizers of the occupation, occupied Alcatraz Island in the San Francisco Bay. Around 90 people kept the occupation going for an amazing 19 months in the face of incredible pressures, as you can only imagine. She was part of the student group that initially organized and led the occupation of Alcatraz. And she'll also be discussing her new book, just coming out soon, called Native Resistance, An Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Life. Good morning, Lineda.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is Jacqueline Keeler. So, yes.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah. As a Native journalist, I'm just so honored to talk to you and to discuss this momentous occasion, this momentous 50-year anniversary of the of Alcatraz, and which I think everyone of my generation grew up hearing about and has basically set the stage for, the Red Power movement, just a complete change in the way that we as Native people relate to our identity.
Yes, that's right. It happened.
Yeah. Could you? So you were planning. There's a big 50th anniversary. Being planned right now for Alcatraz. Could you tell us a little about what's going to happen?
Yes, our 20th anniversary will be on, our 50th anniversary will be on November 20th, and we'll be hosting our veteran Alcatraz people who came out during that time, and of course there's not too many of us, but we have the children and grandchildren as well now, so we're welcoming all our people out to the island, and of course everybody, you know, is welcome. And we'll be setting off several topics on current issues that are still going with murdered, missing Indigenous women and men, and the sacred sites, you know, with Bears Ears and Mauna Kea, and the various issues with migration, you know, our people in Ecuador, Guatemala, I should say, who are related to us linguistically through our tribes, are the ones that are being sent out, taken away, separated from their parents. And of course, we went through that experience as well years ago. So we'll be discussing all the many issues that are going on in South America, you know, with the genocide that's going on there with the people there, and the mining, the fracking, the oil spills. You know, we have so many issues. We've just digressed back to the termination era.
Yeah, could you, going to the termination era, could you talk a little bit about sort of what set the stage for Alcatraz, for you personally, and also, you know, nationally for Native people?
Well, the year in the 60s, we were going through a lot on the reservations with the increased poverty and the cycle of dysfunction from the boarding school generations, as well as our culture and languages that were determined to be illegal. And we couldn't get jobs off the reservation because of this discrimination and racism going on in the local towns. And it was at a pretty heightened degree at that time. It's lessened over the years, but it's still there. In 1964, they passed the Civil Rights Act, so they had to take down the signs, "No Indians or Dogs Allowed." But it didn't change the people, and there was no education because of the lack of history of our people and what happened. And a lot of non-Indian Americans thought that this was their country and their land, and they had no idea of the history of what we went through and how our people were killed. So and if they did, they didn't want to know about it. So it's been kind of an invisible history of our people. So when they sent us out in, you know, as the children of the boarding school people that were mandated to go to those horrible boarding schools and had to go through the physical abuse, mental, spiritual, and sexual abuse that initiated that cycle of dysfunction on the reservation, then coupled with the poverty, we were the next generation, and they were going to take care of the Indian problem, quote unquote, by pushing us out into the cities and assimilating us into the mainstream of American society.
It was called
the Bureau of Indian Affairs Relocation Program. I was 18 when I went to San Francisco by myself, but, you know, I thought I was all grown up. And had a chance to meet with many other Native people out there in the cities. It was like, you know, even though the city was filled with many other people, it was like an abundance for us because we were from many different tribes, and we just kind of all went to each other. You know, we knew each other, and it was like there were many of us. So it was really exciting and really awesome to meet all the Native people. And we just got together. That was the first time I ever heard of powwows, that term, because, you know, they were our ceremonial dances at one time. But we went into, we had a place to center around with the Indian Center for our powwows and conferences. And then we made our move to get into the universities.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that. We've got the period, the 1960s. Obviously, an incredible ferment was happening. You already had, you know, the fishing rights struggle in the Northwest started to raise some of the visibility. You had the beginnings of, you know, the Red Power movement and also the American Indian movement. And then, as you said, you had the American Indian Center, which brought a lot of people from a lot of different nations and tribes from around the country. And then, you know, you had the San Francisco Bay Area itself, which was such a center of activity. And then I saw there's a photograph on the Censored News has a review of your new book that's coming out, in which you're participating in the Third World Liberation Front strike. So talk a little bit about that overall very potent milieu that seemed to be brewing at the time.
Well, the book is out, and I heard from a couple of people that they received it in the mail already. So it's been released, and there's just so much detail, you know, that I had to write a book. And at the 50th, I had to make sure at least, you know, I told the story about what was going on and what happened at that time, but there wasn't an American Indian movement at the time. There was, you know, in 1968 they evolved as a neighborhood watch out of the city of Minneapolis, and evolved from there. So when we were in California and we decided that we wanted to go to the universities, of course the Bureau of Indian Affairs didn't want to support us on that issue, and we had our first protest at the BIA. And, you know, a lot of the older people didn't like it in the Bay Area, because, you know, they were saying, oh, the Indians don't protest. And but we just got with the flow with everybody else and what was going on. And of course, in the local universities, San Francisco State and at UC Berkeley, you know, it was a continuous hotbed of demonstrations and young people, you know, resisting, fighting against the Vietnam War for free speech, et cetera. So, you know, when I saw that happening, that's where I wanted to go, was to the University of California. And I found out that a black group in the Mission District called the Mission Rebels were sending their youth to UC Berkeley, so I asked them if they would send me to UC Berkeley as well, and they agreed, and so I became the first Native American student at UC Berkeley in 1968.
Awesome.
And as a result, I was able to recruit more Native American students with the support of the Chicano organization. And after I think I had over a dozen students, and we organized and established our Native American student organization. And it took about a year. In about that time, then the Third World Strike was going on at San Francisco State, and they were organizing at Berkeley to do the same thing. And they asked if the Native American students wanted to join. And of course, we wanted Native American studies too, so we agreed and we joined the Third World Strike. And since I was the chair of the group, then I, you know, became one of the leads in the Third World Strike to represent Native Americans. As long as I was there, then everybody knew Native Americans were there. So I had to take a pretty lead role in that, and I had a lot of support from the blacks, the Asians, and the Chicanos, and they were most respectful. And, you know, they were all, I think there were three or four, there were always several of the other male leaders in the other groups, and then there was just me. And they were very accommodating and always gave me advice, and it was really, really great to have that support. So organizing and being in that Third World Strike for Native American Studies was really supportive, a good thing to, you know, help me know what I needed to do for getting us into the academic institutions in America, because we were completely left out. We didn't even exist. And of course, we wanted our true histories told, and we wanted people to learn about us, because it's the only way to fight racism and discrimination is to know each other, you know, to know what happened in the history in the past. And of course, there was a big move to not allow us, you know, including, you know, the other groups. They didn't want us in there, but we were successful in the end. We had the most violent strike on campus in the 60s with the Third World Strike. Wow. And of course, we were nonviolent. We didn't, you know, take up arms or anything, but not only did we support each other and have really good unity, but the white students joined and supported us as well as, you know, the professors and everyone else. So it was very successful, but the administration brought out the National Guard. I think it was Reagan at the time. He brought out, he was the
governor
of California. Yeah. Wow. And he brought out the National Guard with the unshielded bayonets, and the helicopters dropped pepper gas on campus. And, you know, they actually stopped classes, which made us successful because we negotiated for our interdisciplinary Department of Ethnic Studies as a first in the nation. And the same thing that happened at San Francisco State, they negotiated 2 weeks after we did. So we became the first in the country to have ethnic studies. 50 years ago, we're celebrating our anniversary for Third World Studies as well. Mm-hmm. And also, when it happened at Berkeley, and we established our departments, it went throughout the whole entire University of California system, and there was like about, I don't know, maybe 10 other University of California campuses throughout California. So we had kind of a an instant kind of a pull to bring in Native American studies and our students in onto the college campuses.
Wow, that's amazing.
So with that, you know, we didn't have cell phones at the time or anything, darn it. You know, they call each other, you know, and we never thought of taking selfies or anything like that. You know, we were just so busy doing what we were doing. I'm surprised that, you know, we have any kind of photos at all. But when we took Alcatraz with all the students, I think there's about 89 of us with our families. They came throughout the state of California, because we just picked up the phone and called all the Native American Studies departments, and all the students and young people came with their families. So we went out and took the island and started our 19-month occupation.
Wow, that is amazing. Yeah, if any of you would like to, this is the call-in show, Wednesday Talk Radio, and we are interviewing Lenaida Warjack, who is, she was one of the original activists who started the takeover of Alcatraz by the Native occupation that occurred 50 years ago. And you can call in to the studio at 503-231-8187 if you want to be part of the conversation. That was an amazing recounting of the solidarity that went into growing the movement that took place at Alcatraz. And so, you know, maybe describe what it was like on the island once you were there. How did that evolve?
Well, it was a challenge. You know, we didn't have any water, electricity, or heat, or any of that, but we managed to, you know, bring those items to the island, and the government took away the water barge, but so we just started loading water and bringing it over, and they cut off the electricity, but we still managed. And then, you know, we moved down to the second level after our initial winter up on the top, on the prison side. We had our dining room right there in the dining room where all the prisoners ate. But it was a challenging experience, but we just kept busy. And I had my 2.5-year-old son with me, Danon. They called him the Alcatraz Kid because he was everywhere, and, you know, because I had to be everywhere to be with me. So his days on the island was, you know, when we got off the island and we were in Washington, D.C., the cab driver, when we got out, asked him, "Where are you from?" And he says, "I'm from Alcatraz." So, you know, his first recollections was from the island, and he still remembers, you know, being on that island. But the kids had their own group, and they did everything together. And of course, we had our own group. There were so many, you know, individual kind of leaders, the ones that led security, the ones that did the cooking, set up the school. You know, we just had so many talented Native people that came out to the island, and some were able to bring their families and stay. So it was an incredible event that, you know, we just kind of set up our own little community.
Wow.
Well, it sounds like we have one caller. This is just incredibly rich and full story that you're recounting. People really should get your book, Native Resistance, an Intergenerational Fight for Survival in Life, which you say is now out, and I will get a copy of that myself, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk to you more about that in the future. But before we continue to your story, which recounts, again, 50 years of Native resistance from before up through Alcatraz and through to Standing Rock and beyond, and you were involved in a fair number of these. We really want to hear more about that. Let's go to our first caller, though. Go ahead, caller, and identify yourself and ask your question, please.
Zambichu. My name is Becky, and I'm from Vancouver, Washington. Good morning, Lenita.
Zambichu.
I wanted to ask you if you could speak a little bit about the advancement of Native policy with the occupation and how that helped Native people on a national level.
Awesome, yes. Well, the president that everybody hated was the first and only, I might add, president that ever helped Native people, and that was Richard Nixon. The first thing he did was he stopped the termination policy initiated in the 1950s by Eisenhower. And that Termination Act, as it was referred to and called, was allowed the states to assume jurisdiction and take lands. And it wiped out the complete state of California, where they took everything and the tribes were not recognized, and Washington, Oregon, Minnesota, 106 tribes were taken out at that time. And of course, in the state of Idaho, where I live, they took over, I think, 8 areas of jurisdiction. And of course, they never did enforce it here, because then they found out they had to fund it. So we wound up assuming those areas, you know, all the time anyway. But
that's Idaho you're talking about.
Right. But it did impact and hurt a lot of tribes and push the assimilation process further along. But Nixon also not only terminated that law by executive order, he initiated Native American policy. His White House address was on Native American people, and he initiated legislation to support Natives, including doubling and tripling the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service budget. So he actually did something for Native people at that time, which promoted all Native people within the nation, from the reservations on through to, say, Indians in the federal government that were working. So it was something that helped everybody, and for Native American people in the cities, they were able to organize more Native American organizations to promote and support their people. And it was just, you know, not only politically, but also within our Native people, they began to identify as Native people again, rather than continue into that assimilation process. So it just kind of backfired on the federal government of how they were trying to assimilate us. Then everything just kind of started rolling back, where Native people were proud to be who they were. They wanted to identify with their tribes and their culture. And then to go out and go back to their people and seek out what that culture meant and what it was, because when Congress made it illegal for us to speak our languages or practice our culture and songs and dances, then it had a really harmful impact on our people, because then they started the taking the children away and putting them into the government and boarding schools to further assimilate them. So, you know, getting our culture back, and fortunately it was still alive, you know, the spirit of our culture was still there, and the re-identification process began again. And so we just had to continue on throughout the years to maintain the resistance of assimilation and bringing our own people and cultures back again.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I think it's ironic that the termination, the U.S. actively had a termination policy through the 1940s, through the 1960s. And then the Relocation Act, which was passed by Congress in 1956, sought to, you know, not only terminate the tribes, but to remove the young people from the reservation and put them in urban centers around the country. And the irony is that this program actually galvanized and a movement, because suddenly all these young people were there together in these cities. My parents went to on relocation to Cleveland, Ohio, and suddenly you have like 20,000 young Native people in a city where they weren't there before, right? And suddenly they're organizing together and active, and this happened all over the country, and this really, you know, actually created this movement, and then of course created this policy change, you know, that then Nixon enacted, which was, you know, is as you said, as unpopular as he is, and rightly so in many ways. You know, he did fundamentally change a policy which was actually focused on our political extinction, right? And
exactly,
stopped
right
in its tracks. And so 1970 was a pivotal year for Indian country. And we talk about sovereignty now, we talk about tribes as nations, and all of that grows out of that moment that you were a part of in 1969. And Becky, are you still on?
Yes, I am.
Maybe I know that you and Lynette are from the same reservation, the Shoshone Bannock in Idaho. What, as a younger person there, how did you feel the work that she was doing? How did you understand it in your own community?
It was an exciting time to know that we were seeing the dawn of something new happen. My family was in San Joaquin Valley at the time, and would go back to Fort Hall, Idaho in the summers with our grandmother. But with Lynetta's presence and the other students there, we were aware that great change was coming and that we would no longer feel invisible.
And Lynetta, how did it feel like seeing that change happen and across the country?
Well, it was pretty amazing, and I never once thought that, you know, our acts of defiance, I knew it was, you know, we needed to direct our energies into a positive direction, and that was the best thing that we could do, but had no idea that it would be what actually happened. And I'm just now finally realizing everything after writing the book and researching and everything, just finally realizing the impact of it all.
Well, Becky, if you have anything else to say, say it. Otherwise, maybe we could let you go and have other people join the conversation.
Thank you. Yes, Lynetta, I'm looking forward to the book, and I'm looking forward to seeing you next week on Alcatraz.
Hey, all right. See you later.
Okay, well, thank you. Good to hear from you.
Bye.
Becky. Oh, we got another caller. Go ahead, caller, identify yourself and give us what you have to say. Maybe we lost him.
So I'd also like to say that Lynetta's book, Native Resistance, and about the intergenerational fight for Indigenous survival, There's a link to it on our webpage for the show, and you can purchase it there. And Lineda, you know, the cover of the book features your father, right?
Right.
Could you tell us a little about the intergenerational aspect of this fight?
Well, I go back to the genocide and when those things were happening, because it happened more recently in the West, because that movement came from the East to the West, and then they started in from the West coming in. So we got caught in those last wars along with the Apaches, and they were putting the people on Alcatraz, all the war leaders. So my great-grandfather was to Monmouth, was sent there. Wow. But, you know, he had someone to speak for him, and so they went ahead and sent him back. But same thing with the Paiute leader, Natchez, and Numaga. He was sent back. He had his sister speak for him. That was Chief Winnemucca's son. And so it kind of goes, you know, through the generations of what happened. And of course, I got to hear the story of my great-grandfather, which through my dad. And he was raised by his grandmother, so she, you know, told him the story of what happened at that time. And then he became the tribal leader, my dad did. And he was fighting against the Indian Land Claims Act at that time, which was passed in 1951. It legitimized the largest land steal of native land from Canada to Mexico under the Shoshone Nation Land Claims Act. And so he, you know, resisted that. And then, of course, Public Law 280 that was passed in 1951. So when he did his resistance, it was during the McCarthyism era, and he was chairman of the tribe, so they called him a communist, and they did everything they could to get rid of him, and they eventually did. But I was raised in that whole climate because I and my dad were very close. So, you know, I knew of his work and what happened and the kind of resistance we went through. And then I became a part of that story of resistance with Alcatraz. So it just, you know, continues on from there.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that kind of the occupation of Alcatraz kind of set a pattern of occupations, which wasn't the sum, any far from the sum total or the, you know, the necessarily the main thrust of Native activism, which was many faceted, but it did create a lot of visibility. So I'd like to hear more about that. But we do have our caller back on the line. So go ahead, caller, identify yourself and ask your question, please.
Oh, thanks. Can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Okay, my name is Mitch Ritter, and I was studying at Berkeley from 80 to 83 in the Mass Comm Department, and I'm very happy to have Lineda on the air and always happy to hear Jacqueline Keeler on the air. My question has to do with probably the most influential professor in my history. I continue to take courses even after I stopped being an undergraduate, not just at Berkeley, anywhere I could. And my most informative professor was teaching at Berkeley. His name was Terry Wilson, and he had written the book on the Osage history that Americans knew so little about, how the Osages were the first tribe to get their mineral rights at the time when the oil boom hit Oklahoma, and how they became the most wealthy people on earth at one point, wealthier than the Saudis are now. And there was so little coverage, I was glad, actually, that the Mass Comm Department at Berkeley was an interdisciplinary, because I could have professors like Terry Wilson in my on my curriculum and learn about the structural impediments to broadcast media covering more about Native American history and issues. And I was wondering if Lineda could speak about Terry's work and what she remembers about that.
Hi, well, I was already gone. I graduated in 71, so I didn't really get to know him, but I'm really glad that he was there and that he did speak about that. And the Osage, of course, you know, after becoming so wealthy, you know, there was all the murder and the fraud and, you know, things that happened, unfortunately, and, you know, that still has to be, it has to come out, you know, what happened and how they stole all the wealth when the Osage became wealthy. But my dad used to talk about the Osage in, when he was in Indian boarding school, and, you know, how everybody knew that they were the most wealthy, and I guess he says that when they had new clothes, they would just buy new clothes whenever they got dirty, and he says they would just discard them, and here all the Indians were there to pick them up to go wash them and have new clothes. So it was really a pitiful time for everybody, but you know, that really needs to come out. And I'm so glad he wrote a book, and I'll be checking that out.
Yeah, the book, there's a movie, Martin Scorsese is directing a film called Killers of the Flower Moon, and they're actually casting for extras right now and actors in Oklahoma, and so that will feature that awesome. Those murders.
And there was a very popular book just a few years ago on the Osages that referenced Terry's work, but I remember standing in a lecture hall, because it was standing room only when he lectured, and we're talking about a lecture hall at UC Berkeley of over 100 spaces for 100 seats, and it was standing room only. And he was just so charismatic and funny and human.
Okay.
And
thank you so much.
Terrific.
Thanks, Mitch. We've got only 20 minutes left, we invite other callers. We only have about 20 minutes, 503-231-8187. This opportunity to talk with Lineda Warjack, who was one of the organizers of the and participants in the occupation of Alcatraz 50 years ago. Started November 20th, 1969. She has a new book, Native Resistance and Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Life. Again, we have open lines, 503-231-8187.
Yeah. And Lineda, could you, I guess, maybe speak a little bit to the invocation of the treaty, the Fort Laramie Treaty, that underlay the demands made at Alcatraz. Can you describe a little bit how the treaty was invoked?
Okay, right after the island was vacated, then a Lakota landing party came out and claimed the island under their treaty, which stipulated in part that the land could revert back to Native tribes. It was termed as surplus property. So they did that under that clause. And, of course, it was federal Indian law as well that federal surplus property would revert back to Indians if they so claimed. So when, in 1969, when it became an issue in the Bay Area that it was going to be turned over to be a casino under Lamar Hunt, then to us it was a slap in the face, because they were not going to acknowledge an Indian treaty. And so it was enough for us to say, okay, you know, they broke every single treaty in the United States, and this is another one, so they're not going to acknowledge, you know, federal law. So it was enough of an insult for us to go out there and stake claim to the island. And unfortunately, we didn't acknowledge the people of the land, the Ohlone, because we were just going after the law and the injustices and everything that was going on. But we had California Indian students with us, and so we didn't, you know, really, you know, think about that at the time. But that treaty was the same language, that same language in every other treaty that we were aware of as well.
I see, yeah. And it was mostly college students, Native college students, wasn't it, initially, or?
Well, it was yeah, the college students. We were organized in the Bay Area through San Francisco State and UC Berkeley, and then we called on the rest of the college students from the University of California universities and took the island.
So 19 months. I mean, you were at Standing Rock as well, didn't you? You went and that was from April 1st until I guess they evacuated in February. But 19 months is a long time to hold an occupation. How did that go? I guess how much coverage did it get in the media at the time? I think like compared to Standing Rock.
Well, we were in international waters, so we had international focus and attention, and we had a lot of international press. Not too much local, but because all the media, a lot of the media is owned by the federal corporations, and of course they don't want to hear about us resisting pipelines or breaking treaties, you know, they don't want to hear that. But with the Standing Rock, it was the same kind of issues, and I didn't run into a lot of people I knew from the day, but because most of everybody's gone, but I did run into the children and grandchildren, so, and met a lot of new friends. And I wasn't in the center of it or anything like that. I was just there as a supporter. So it was a difficult situation, you know, staying in that in North Dakota because of the cold. Whereas we were on the island, it wasn't, you know, we had shelter. We stayed in the guards' quarters, the guards' houses, and it was much more comfortable, you know, and we were able to exist in that way.
I was really interested. I think we may have another caller, but, you know, we do only have about 15 minutes left. I'd like to hear maybe just some more of the highlights. You know, you cover, you know, 50 years or more of Native resistance. And I know you must have participated or certainly been, you know, involved in some way in a lot of the other events that kind of ensued out of the occupation of Alcatraz. Maybe some of the things that maybe people aren't as familiar with. You know, there's obviously the BIA takeover in Washington. There's Wounded Knee. But maybe talk about a few of the things maybe people haven't heard of.
Well, I was going to law school in D.C. at the time that the BIA takeover happened. I believe that was in the fall of 72. And I knew everybody there, and I actually got blamed for it, too, because, you know, there's so many people coming to my house, and I guess they went and had all the telephone transcripts, and was facing a federal indictment, but yet they couldn't really use the information coming out of my house and all of my friends, because at that time, and I don't know if it changed, that you had to have permission, you know, from the person. So I knew everybody there, but I was going to law school, so I wasn't really, you know, a part of that per se, other than, you know, just keeping up with what was going on. The Commissioner of Indian Affairs, Louis Bruce, said that all of his employees' kids were in the building, and of course he got threatened with they were going to go in there forcibly and remove everyone, and that he should not be in the building at that time. And of course he was there at that time, and so they couldn't really do a forcible removal, and he had, before he took the position, they had him sign his resignation so that, you know, if he ever went against them, then they could pull that out on him. And they did. They pulled that out on him. And then he said, he was telling me that they had a list of law students that were in the building. And I wasn't in the building, but associated with the takeover. And they pulled all our law scholarships and then sent it all through contract to New Mexico so that they could pick and pull, you know, whoever they deemed as credible or who they wanted to go to law school. So they kind of pick and chose their lawyers of who was going to go into the system at that time. But it was quite an experience, and I didn't go on to law school, but I did eventually go on and finish my doctorate degree because it was really hard to get my transcripts. But I had filed, for some reason, I sent my transcripts when I graduated from Berkeley to Idaho State University, and it was 20 years old, but it was still official transcripts, so I was able to get in and finish my doctorate degree. But you know, it was, I kind of described some of the things that happened at that time, and I wasn't necessarily a part of that, but in a way, you know, I guess for Native people, we're all related to each other, you know, so it's hard to say I'm different because, or I didn't do that, but you know, we're just all guilty by association, I guess, so.
Great. We have another caller on the line. Caller, please identify yourself. Hello.
Hi, Lenita. This is Michelle. Michelle Guzman.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Well, I'm good.
I'm here in Portland, and I hear you're on KBOO, so I had to turn on KBOO, my childhood station here.
Awesome.
So, what I wanted to ask you was, knowing that you were a young person in the 60s and going to this movement and all this, you know, exciting time happening, and I work with young people, and I oftentimes refer back to, you know, what happened in the late 60s and the 70s with them. But for our young people today, as they become, you know, knowledgeable and aware about history and notes and learn things, do you have any advice for them as they, you know, especially with fracking going on and they're trying to organize, or they want to support and help their communities and the things that happen in their communities? Because, you know, many tribes have so many different issues going on, whether it's fracking or mineral, water rights. They have all these issues. Would you have any advice that you would like to share with them or give them?
Well, I think that they're already doing that by becoming informed and learning their history and being ready to talk about it, you know, with the best information possible, but also by understanding and knowing their culture and utilizing the prayers that we have, because it's our prayers and our ceremonies and everything that got us through the genocide and the boarding schools and everything we've been going through. It's the foundation and the basis of the whole spiritual movement, because no matter how we're organized, you know, it's still that spirituality that's going to give us that support to stay alive and keep going. So,
mm-hmm. Okay.
So,
well,
I think
speaking
speaking
of spirituality and support, when you guys took over Alcatraz as student groups, did you guys have anybody, or like a spiritual leader or a combination, or how did you guys go about having that component? Or realizing how important that component is?
Well, we didn't actually really realize that, but we did have a lot of spiritual people that we embraced, and Thomas Banyaka came out from the Hopis, and he told us about, you know, maintaining that prayerful spiritual way and be nonviolent. And of course, I got pulled in early, you know, before Alcatraz. There was a spiritual leader from McDermott who was a consultant to Far West Research Laboratories, where I was working during the time I was suspended from Berkeley, because I got arrested during the strike. But he took me to McDermott with his family, and there were some people from Fort Hall there, and they had ceremonies for me all night. And then when I went back to Fort Hall with the people that came in from Fort Hall, then they continued to have ceremony for me and do prayers for me. It was a meeting, all-night meeting. And so, you know, it's always been there. And then my mother always told me about sunrise and prayers to the sun. So, you know, when I got hurt on the island, I, you know, used those prayer ways, you know, to support me. We had individuals coming in to do UEPs and sweat lodge ceremonies. So we had, you know, certain ones that came in and came to try to help us, Mad Bear Anderson, you know, the Iroquois people, Pete Mitten, you know, different ones came in at different times to try to help us and keep us strong. So
that's beautiful.
It was all helpful in the end.
Talk about in your book that you have coming out, because I think a lot of time that component gets overlooked. You know, everybody, you know, looks at the actions that happen, but the foundation of a lot of our strength as Indian people are prayers and ceremonies. Is that anything you cover in your book?
If it isn't, it's coming in the second edition. I'll write that down and make sure that, you know, because, you know, it just kind of, 50 years is hard to summarize, and,
true.
You know, there's just so much, and I had to get it out, so I thought, well, in the second edition, I'll just take note on everything that everybody has to say, and I really appreciate that, to make sure that people know, because it's the prayers that come from our heart and soul, and it comes out through voice, and voice is sound. And with the dancing and the drums, the heartbeat of Mother Earth, it activates that, and it travels, sound travels on light to the plants and animals, to the people, and that's how we maintain life and land in balance and blessings and abundance, you know, for our people. So, yeah, I do talk about that, but I don't know if I said this is how we kept going, but I'll check that out, and I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
There's a beautiful video of you on YouTube leading from 2017 from the Alcatraz sunrise ceremony, and you're leading the whole group in a prayer to the sun, and, you know, with their sending their energy and their with their hands up, and it's just a gorgeous. I'd recommend people view it, and we can add it to our webpage. But that was really lovely, and the strength that you got from doing that after you were injured in Alcatraz, that's amazing. I as a Native journalist, I am sometimes reluctant to perform our identity, particularly things as sacred as our culture. I'm Navajo and Yankton Dakota, and you know, in Navajo ways, forbidden. You know, you're not supposed to discuss that stuff with outsiders, with people who are not Navajo, right? And so I sometimes feel like it's sort of, I don't know, I'm very careful about sharing those aspects, because I don't want them to be sort of, you know, appropriated by outsiders who are hungry for those things, those hungry spirits, you know, and those things are deeply personal. And I do think it's important to remember that as well. There's a quote that you gave, you know, to the San Francisco Chronicle at the time when you were a student activist at Alcatraz. And you said, "Here in this white man's prison, we have found freedom for the first time." Could you speak a little to that?
Well, the freedom was, you know, after we got sent to the cities, you know, we didn't have Bureau of Indian Affairs or tribal governments over us. We were just free to be who we were. And, of course, liberating Alcatraz was a part of that freedom that we were expressing. So, yes, we we were free, and we were taking our land back. We were identifying. We were learning our spirituality and raising that consciousness. You know, everything didn't happen exactly at the time, but it initiated what happened later on. So I guess that's what I'm referring to.
That's beautiful. So,
well, we're about out of time, Lenita, and we really appreciate your taking the time. Maybe we'll have an opportunity to talk to you again. Obviously, there's way more than could be talked about in an hour. Again, the 50th anniversary of the occupation of Alcatraz is coming up on November 20th. There's going to be it's always a sunrise ceremony right there at Alcatraz for that.
Well, I'm staying for that. The International Treaty Council is going to have the no taking day.
No Thanksgiving taking.
on the island. And
And what day will that be?
That's on Thanksgiving.
Okay.
That'll be Thanksgiving. So I'll be staying over the following week for that. And participating in that sunrise.
Yeah, there's two different events. On November 20th, on next Wednesday, I think, they will be celebrating the 50th anniversary of the takeover of Alcatraz, which was on November 20th, 1969. And then the following week...
Through the
23rd. There'll be 3 days of Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And then the following week on Thanksgiving, then they have their celebration sunrise ceremony, which they've had every year since then. So
no thanks taking,
that's it.
Okay, well, we gotta run. Thank you so much, Lenita, really appreciate it.
Wonderful talking to you.
All right.
Honored.
Thank you. Bye.
And that's wraps up Wednesday Talk Radio for another week. Thank you to my co-host Jacqueline Keeler. We'll be with you the second Wednesday of next month once again.
Like the Indian has, few have seen your beauty like the Indian has. To many you've been a nightmare, to the Indian a dream come true, because he cared, because he cared. Alcatraz, 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 few have seen your beauty like the Indian.